you need to ask Judy Wood. Before you accuse someone, you better make damn sure you know what was done. Seismic impact so small. I know that something's wrong. 8 seconds, the North Tower's gone. I'd tell you if I could, but you need to ask Judy Wood. Before you accuse someone, you better make sure you know how it was done.
Well, this is Ralph Kermit Winterode II coming to you live out of Alaska today. And we're up to, we're down to 16 hours and 40 minutes of daylight. We've lost almost 2 hours already since June 21st. It's amazing how this starts to slip away up here, but we're into a comfortable 59 degrees and partly cloudy. So we're not doing too bad yet compared to a lot of places in the lower 48. Today the subject is going to be, haven't had Dr. Judy Wood, Andrew Johnson on. I think we may have a third guest also joining us, Robert, I think. Haven't had them on for a while. And it's absolutely astounding, shocking actually, to what happened in New York, 911, and the cover-up of the truth. We'll be back in a minute. Stay tuned. Okay, we're back from break here, and we're going to have three guests on today. And the first guest is Dr. Judy Wood. She has written a book called Where Did the Towers Go? And she has the only complete independent forensic investigation of 911. She is highly qualified to write the book. She has a civil engineering degree, a BS in civil engineering. She has a degree in structural engineering, applied physics and materials and engineering science. Extremely highly qualified to do. She actually has the qualifications that would be required to do a complete forensic investigation for one person. And like I say, she's written a book, Where Did the Towers Go.com. Are you there, Dr. Wood?
Yes, hello.
Yeah, well, thanks for being on the show. And before we get started, and I forget here because we want to give it a couple times, you want to give out how they can get a copy of your book, which is an amazing book, textbook, actually.
Go to WhereDidTheTowersGo.com. It's all one word. It's hard to type because there's no space. It's just wherediddetowersgo.com. Or you can go to my regular website, drjudywood.com, which is drjudywood.com.
Okay, and you used to teach at Clemson University?
Yes.
And you're no longer there. And also we're going to have joining us from the UK or England, I'm not sure which is most correct there, Andrew Johnson. He has a degree in computer science and physics. Are you with us, Andrew?
I'm here, Ralph. Thanks for inviting me back onto your program.
Yeah, and you have written a book also on all of the stuff that's been going on in the attacks of the truth. And why don't you give out your webpage here initially, too, so people can follow along if they want to.
Yeah, if you go to checktheevidence.com, that's all one word, obviously, and you'll find a banner there about a book called 9/11 Finding the Truth, if you click around a little bit. And you can click on that and go to a page, and you can download a free Kindle version. It's available free for the iPad for those that have those nice little devices. And there's a paperback version as well if you want to get the hard copy.
Okay, and we have a third guest. And why don't you introduce your name and your qualifications? We've not met before, but go ahead.
Yeah, thank you very much. My name is Rob. I'm a professional engineer. I work in the Pacific Northwest and run my own engineering firm. I've written at times in support of Judy Wood of published articles doing that. It's an area that still is quite controversial, and for that reason I've kept a lower profile than Andrew has. But it's still very important to me, and it's a very important topic, obviously, as it is to everyone. And I have offered my strenuous support of Dr. Wood's abilities as an engineer and abilities as a writer and researcher, and just absolutely in total admiration of her efforts on this topic.
Well, she's not walked an easy road because she's been vilified, named everything in the world, self-published her book. I mean, she's done it all. To get there from here. And what I would like to do before we get into some of the other stuff like the Vancouver hearing and some of the naysayers, why don't we lay a foundation of the real facts for the people of what happened in New York on 9/11. Go ahead.
Well, I'd like to say that the buildings did not burn up, nor did they slam to the ground, but they turned into dust in midair. And how do we know this? If they had slammed to the ground, we'd have a pile of debris at the end of the day. That didn't happen. If they slammed to the ground, the seismic signal would have reflected that. And that didn't happen either. And if they slammed to the ground, the bathtub they were in, which is really a dike that goes around the base of the building, because the buildings were built in the Hudson River, 70 feet below the water table. That's where the bedrock was. So they had this dike around the towers. If you had dropped two 500,000-ton buildings onto that dike, you would have busted it. Busting that would have flooded pretty much all of lower Manhattan, all of the subway stations and the subway tunnels. So that didn't happen. But what did happen is an abundance of dust, lots of dust.
So how much of the 500,000 tons of how much actually arrived on the ground?
Well, not as a solid chunk. You know, some of it, who knows if it ever did land, because some of it went way up in, you know, into the atmosphere and traveled down the eastern seaboard. You can see that from satellite images. If there's various ways of looking at it, but approximately 80% of the solid material turned to dust. If everything above, like the 20th story, had been turned to dust, and you just dropped the bottom 16 to 20 stories, it would have left approximately the same seismic signal as what was recorded for the two towers. And there's a couple of other buildings that rarely get talked about, too. Building 7 made essentially no seismic signal that was really very detectable from background noise. And Building 3 went away, and that one never gets talked about. That was a 22-story building, which would be one of the largest buildings in most towns. And that one just went away.
How many buildings total?
7. And it happened to be all the buildings with the WTC prefix that were destroyed.
And the only ones supposedly that got hit by an airplane, regardless, we're not going to get really into that, were two buildings, the two towers. So we have 5 other buildings that day turned to dust.
Destroyed.
And there was no airplanes.
And the not 100% of the buildings turned to dust, but significant portions, like the middle of Building 6 went missing. The main body of Building 4 went missing, and Building 5 had what looked like a post hole digger, you know, cored out cylindrical holes in the building.
Now, I think one of the most astounding, first of all, when you look at the video, this is not like a controlled demolition that we've seen, used to seeing where it all in caves in. The only one that has sort of that appearance is Building 7. But there's video showing all afternoon of stuff, material. Looks like it's going straight out, all one side being just sucked out, right?
Right. It's just one side and one side only, from ground to roof, for most of the day. And then in the last hour of its life, it was two faces, but only two faces from ground to roof.
And now we know. Now, seismic signals is a. There is no doubt about seismic being a good scientific indicator about seismic signals and that. Is that true?
Correct. If amount of energy is, you know, impacts the ground, or amount of mass impacts the ground with a certain amount of energy, that is registered on the seismic chart. And there's numerous seismic charts in the area. And again, the tower sat on bedrock, so it'd be like ringing a tuning fork. That wouldn't get muffled between where the towers existed and where the recording station was.
Now, you analyzed in your book more than one seismic recording station, so we can eliminate that there's some fluke there. And the one that a lot of the people like to point to is Building 7. And what did the seismic, all these seismic recorders show for Building 7?
Well, it essentially is no seismic event, except if you look at it real carefully and, you know, some imagination, maybe something here, maybe it's a little bit of, you know, disturbance there. But what was really striking it is that there was no S or P wave. The P wave is the primary wave that first arrives at the recording station, and the secondary wave is the bigger, you know, higher amplitude wave that arrives after that. And the delay between the two is how they know how far away from the seismic station the epicenter was. But for Building 7, there was actually, for none of the towers, 1, 2, or 7, was there a detectable P wave or S wave. Those are generated from the signal traveling through the Earth. The only thing that was recorded was a surface wave.
So what's that telling me if we don't have the P and S waves? We just have a surface wave. What's that telling me?
That the signal did not travel through the Earth.
And what's that mean?
It didn't slam to the ground.
It didn't have enough energy to create those waves that are ground-borne vibration, essentially. So basically, it that piece of information is as revealing as anything. It simply says that the energy that you would have expected from a 500,000-ton building crashing into the ground simply wasn't detectable that day. It didn't happen. 500,000 tons of concrete and steel didn't hit the ground that day, nor did 200,000 tons of concrete and steel hit the ground when Building 7 collapsed.
So that is preclusive in saying then we can preclude that it wasn't a controlled demolition, it wasn't thermite, thermate, or nanothermite, anything related to any type of an explosive. Is that true?
That's absolutely true. That's provable from a number of different points of view as well. It's not that one single piece of data, but that one single piece of data is enough. It's supported by many other pieces of data as well.
And for the surface wave that was recorded, you know, you have a mental image of something like King Kong reaching over and picking up the towers. You know, the towers are no longer there. They went away. So if the towers just suddenly were lifted off the ground, you're lifting this amount of weight off the ground, that's going to cause a surface disturbance.
Well, I think one of the other videos, too, there were several things when I was getting involved in this, and that one video showing those beams standing vertically and dissolving into dust is absolutely astounding video.
That's some of the most compelling information. When I first looked at it, when I first looked at it, that's what jumped out for me, was you could literally see these steel beams disintegrating as they fell to the ground, and it's...
Hold on just a minute. Do I hear music? Yeah, okay, we're going to break back in a minute, and Rod, hold on a minute, we'll finish the thought. Back, we have Dr. Wood, we have Andrew Johnson of UK, and we have Rob. So go ahead and finish your thought there, Rob.
Thanks very much. I wanted to say that the piece of information you've identified is something that anyone really can see when they look at Dr. Wood's book, or look at her website, or look at those photos. The literally elements of the building disintegrate as they fall to the ground. That's again supports the idea that there's nothing about this that resembles a kinetic energy event, an explosion, something like that. It's something very different, and that among many pieces of data we're going to get to today. But it really jumps out at you because you can see in the photographs how, as sections of the building falling, they're turning to dust. It's a remarkable discovery, and it really just knocks you off your feet when you first notice it and realize what that means.
It is, when you're watching the video and all of a sudden you see these big chunks of steel, these, I don't know what they call them, where they're all tied together, and all of a sudden they're just turning to dust as they're falling in midair.
Yeah, you had the same reaction I did. I was just like, wow, look at that. And it was many years ago we both looked at that, but it's really something to behold.
I think it's because it's something to behold, what I found is that there's been a, and hopefully we'll get to this as well, there's been a very strong effort to direct and divert people's attention away from that very obvious fact when you see it, plain as day, in the 10 or 15 seconds it takes to play out, particularly with the 70-story section of unsupported steel. As Rob says, that once that hits you, your jaw drops, and you realise that you're confronted with something which is much more difficult to comprehend initially.
How would we address the issue of they're always hearing this? Well, there was a fire, there was molten metal, and we look out and something that looks like molten metal. Maybe there are a few pictures. We see that out of the side of the building. How would we address that?
Well, in order to find molten metal, you have to have evidence of it. What is the evidence? You have evidence to the contrary, like the whole site covered with water. And if you molten metal, or they claim it's molten iron, that's like, 2,800 degrees. If you put water on it, water, when it becomes steam.
Flashes to steam, yeah, instantly,
It expands, it needs like 1,600 times the volume. So if it suddenly is expanding by 1,600 times, that's a big explosion.
And that never happened?
Nope.
And there's no evidence of any molten metal puddles, because when it's molten iron, when it gets down to Mother Earth, it's going to be there when it cools down so we can find it, and none was found, correct?
Right. It's not going to flow out to the ocean in rivers.
This isn't like Hawaii when we're watching a volcano.
Right. And also, if it solidifies, you'd see big chunks coming out. And something that might be worth noting, I think a lot of people are familiar with Chernobyl, that was caused by a steam explosion.
Okay. That was nuclear steam.
Right.
That's what destroyed that concrete structure. The encasement of the nuclear reactor was a steam explosion. So it just gives you the kind of sense of the energy available when water flashes to steam. It's noticeable. It'll destroy a concrete, reinforced concrete building.
And so go ahead.
And a bunch of rain. Of course, there was all the fire hoses, on things, as well as a huge rain because of the hurricane. A couple of days later, the backside of the hurricane dumped a bunch of rain on the site, and there was no steam explosions. Actually, there was less fuming coming out of the ground when it was raining.
Now, that's another issue, the fuming, but another major issue is you see all these pictures of cars that look like they're on fire, but paper's not burning. And there were cars that were, quote, you labeled them toasted. What, 1,200 to 1,400 toasted cars around the area?
Right. I use the word toasted, not implying this, the cause, but just their toast, their history. Something did them in. I don't use fire or burnt because I don't know that they were burnt. I don't know if it's fire. It acts differently. It may eventually become a fire, but initially it was not. And so I just use toasted. Something toasted these cars. They're done with. You got to get another one. You can't repair it. It's beyond repair.
And they're not right next to the building, though. They're sitting a ways, quite a ways away. So how can that happen? I mean, it can't be the explosion. It can't be the fire or the flames reaching out there, what, a quarter mile away or whatever it was?
Right. And you have a sea of unburned paper between the towers, between the WTC complex and these toasting cars.
The timeline of the event is important, too. Dr. Wood points this out in her book that these cars, which were several hundred yards from the building, the dust cloud, which was moving pretty slowly, I mean, it was a few tens of feet per second. It's people were not able to outrun it, but it wasn't much faster than running speed. As it traveled along the road, and people also reported that the dust cloud felt cold. It wasn't hot, and this idea that it was a pyroclastic flow, something you might associate with a volcano, it actually felt cold. As it passed over the cars, so this low-moving cloud of dust moves over these cars, they appear to have, and it's just an appearance, because we don't have a lot of data other than...
Hold the phone there. Hold the thought. We'll guide the music. We'll be back in a minute. Pay some bills. Back in just a second. Okay, we're back discussing 911. Dr. Wood, Andrew out of the UK, and Rob. Go ahead, Rob. You were finishing a thought.
Yeah, thanks very much. I hope I'm not hogging all the airtime. There's just so many phenomena that we observed that day that are just so incredible. We have a lot of data on them. I hope we get a chance to talk about a lot of them today. But that toasted car thing, it's another piece of evidence that it's just so hard to fit into a sort of a conventional physics model. A cold cloud passes over a car and the car appears to, just saying appears because the only piece of data we have is the visual evidence, and then afterwards the physical evidence of the destroyed car with the rust and the unburned paper. Those are the only piece of evidence we have to go on. It's really something that is just absolutely extraordinary. So maybe Dr. Wood, can you?
Yeah, there's also some eyewitness testimony of this. Like Patrick Connolly, one of the first responders, a firefighter, during one of the tower's demise, he ducked into WTC-7 and decided that wasn't a safe place to be, came out, and he said it was near zero visibility, and he was headed up West Broadway. That's north of the WTC complex. And as he headed up the street, you know, climbing over things, cars started lighting up spontaneously, as if spontaneous combustion. He talked about the tires popping. Just everything was, you know, lighting up and tires were popping. As he walked past them, he wasn't being hit with anything.
Well, see, what's amazing, too, is that there were I don't even have any idea how many filing cabinets were in that building. I think there was partially one of them may have they found, but the paper inside all these filing cabinets seemed to survive quite nicely, but filing cabinets were gone.
Isn't that extraordinary? I know, it's something to behold. Just that Patrick Connolly's eyewitness account as well. I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen a car fire, but it's not something you'd want to be close to. It's often very hot. It's a frightening event. I don't have that sense from his testimony that he was, you know, there was an enormous amount of heat transfer, anything like that. I didn't have that feeling from what he was, what his account described.
There are other first responders who were glad that the cars lit up because then they could see where they were going.
Can you imagine?
Patricia Androvic, her first responder jacket, it's supposed to be fire resistant, lit up. And, you know, she's like a human flashlight, but at least she could see where she was going.
She didn't talk about
being burned.
Yeah. She actually had the jacket on when that happened?
Yeah. They called it a turnout coat. She said they ought to call it a burnout coat.
Can you imagine? Wow.
And the cars were blowing up as she walked past them. That's what she described them as.
Yeah, there were also issues of levitation, weren't there, that people experienced, or cars in this?
Right. There was one fellow who when WTC-2 was turned to dust, he dove under an emergency vehicle. And he thought the end was near, and everything went black. But then when the dust cleared, the sunlight came in, and it was shining down on him, and there's no vehicle over him. He doesn't remember what happened to the vehicle. He didn't remember it rolling off him, or, you know, it's just gone.
And that was similar to the firefighters' experience in the stairwell. They went into the stairwell thinking it was there. You know, they weren't going to make it, and, of course, this 110-story building didn't collapse on them. It vanished from around them, right?
Right. It was just very very amazing. The quote that one of them said, I looked up and said, guys, there used to be 106 floors above us, and now I'm seeing sunshine. There's nothing above us. That big building doesn't exist. You saw sunshine. They later said, these are the biggest office buildings in the world, and I didn't see one desk, one chair, one phone, nothing.
Now, there were also, this is external type things, what some of the people may have experienced that were internal, especially trying to crawl out windows. What's going on there? You have some pictures of people hanging on windows, outside of windows, and
The people called the jumpers. And if you look at them carefully, there's something else going on there. And there's one fellow I really zoomed in on who was from the 105th floor, hanging by one hand and one foot out of the 105th floor window. It looks like he's taking off his pants. And he already has his shirt removed. Then you look and you see other people hanging out of the building without a shirt or pants. So if they're still there, they want to live. Why are they taking their pants off? Clothing protects you from a fire. So why are they outside the building taking their clothes off?
So you that know, leads us to there's some sort of a phenomena going on that the people inside the building are trying to escape from that's not normal.
Right. Like if for some weird reason he wanted to remove his pants, why not just, you know, and if there were smoke inside, why not just take in a big deep breath, step inside, take the pants off, then step back out? You know, what necessitates taking the pants off hanging outside the building from the 105th floor?
Now, what phenomena did you become aware of that could tend to explain a lot of these issues that you were researching out in your empirical evidence?
Well, it is clear to us from our experience that in life that there's energy fields that affect water differently than dry things. Like you put something in a microwave oven, you know, on a paper plate, the paper doesn't burn, but the food on the plate gets cooked. And if you think of that idea, that's a different wavelength than what we're used to seeing. You know, we don't see microwaves. I'm not saying it is microwaves, but there could be some kind of energy field like that that affects the water if they have wet clothing. And it's a good chance they have wet clothing. You know, if the fire sprinklers come on, they're wet. If they're sweating, they're wet. And if it were me up there and if there was a fire, I'd be the first to the bathroom before we lost water pressure, and I would get myself wet. You know, wrap wet clothes around my head and head for the stairwell. So they're probably wet. And there's a thing called active denial system where they use it for breaking up crowds, and like a bunch of protesters. And that is they're firing microwaves at the crowd. And it's said that if you're wet, it's a whole lot worse. It's like getting your skin fried.
Who has demonstrated some of this technology as far as transmutation of elements or levitation or materials turning to dust or vanishing? What did you find out there?
Well, I happened upon someone's blog one night where I, this is after I tallied up all the different phenomena that I'd seen, and instead of trying to force it into some known technology, I was just adding up all the different phenomena. And then I came upon this blog, and wow, this person had reproduced every single one of the phenomena. And turned out that was John Hutchison's blog. So okay. I got to get a hold of this guy, you know, and so I contacted him.
So did you go up to take a look? And
yes, yes, and saw his equipment, saw his samples, saw how it works, and well, not how it works, but that it works. It just you know, it opens your eyes to a whole new world.
So what was he doing?
He would create a static field. He used to use a Tesla coil, but later started using a Van de Graaff generator. And within that static field, he would interfere radio frequency signals like microwaves.
Okay. And then what would he get?
Different things depending on how he mixed it, strengths, and the type of signals, the shape of the waves, and would get anything from, you know, levitation to... So one thing that really caught my eye was lift or disruption. And that is a trend that I noticed at the WTC. Either you have a flip car or a toasted car, you know, totally destroyed. It, you know, the upside down ones were in a whole lot better shape than the right side up ones.
Well, I know one that caught my eye is the one with the iron thing where he gets that. That just looks like a piece of iron is going away.
Right, the solid block of iron, and it fumes some, and it just, it's like it doubles over and crumples up.
And then also evident at the World Trade Center, especially the bank next door, and a lot of these iron things, not only are they twisted and impossible, there's just no way the way they're like a pretzel or whatever, but also the aging of the iron. I mean, it looks like it's been under the ocean for, you know, rust been out and oxidized. It's, how can that happen?
Yeah, I did the same thing Dr. Wood do. I mean, it's something that a reasonable and prudent engineer would do. I made a point of finding John Hutchison and trying to get to know him. He's careful about the people he meets, obviously, but I was lucky enough to go to his lab and see his specimens and see the work he'd done. And, you know, I'm an engineer. I'm not going to say that I know everything, but you can look at the metal samples that are laying there. You can look at his test equipment. You get a pretty clear sense that it's authentic and he's able to reproduce all of the... One of the challenges he's often faced with is that he says that, you know, well, you haven't reproduced it. You haven't published a paper. Well, you know, he doesn't really need to. He's got literally... dozens of samples there, and you know, the work has been sent off to credible metallurgical labs, and they haven't been able to explain the failure phenomena that they see in some of the metal specimens that he sent to them. So there's little doubt about the authenticity of John Hutchison or the incredible achievements he's got or accomplished through his work and through his investigation of material science and the interaction of electromagnetic waves and materials. It's really quite extraordinary. Dr. Wood was actually the person that put the 9/11 story or events and John Hutchison's work together for me. I actually had, because I'd heard of John Hutchison, got to know him for other reasons, and then I started seeing these connections between those two events. He's an authentic, credible researcher, and he's done really phenomenal things. And if anyone asks, have they been repeated, you only need to look now at Dr. Wood's book, and you can say they've all been repeated. They're plain as day.
And very repeatable. We got, you know, two towers that went way identically, just about.
Yeah, have a look.
But okay. has Hutchison repeated, you know, his work? Of course, you've seen pictures of him with like 50 different samples.
Yeah,
they didn't happen at the same time.
No, and of course.
Okay, so what is this technology called, and what might be a physicist or a scientist that we're seeing some evidence maybe of what he had discovered way back when?
Well, I don't know what you know, in the out of the controlled environment, what they call this, but I have identified it as magnetic electrogravitic nuclear reactions.
That's an accurate description, I feel. And you know, one of the problems of talking about this particular area of science is there's a lot of nonsense and a lot of misinformation. So we have to be very careful with the words we choose and the way we characterize this, because if you're to type in Tesla or T.T. Brown on the Internet, you get mountain ranges of information. A lot of it's quite muddled, and maybe they're just to distract people. I'm not really sure. So Hutchison's different in a sense, in that that his stuff is real. You can touch it. It's sitting there right in front of you. But that characterization that Dr. Wood has given it is accurate. It is a nuclear electrogravitic...
And magnetic.
Magnetic, yes, magnetic event. And yeah, go ahead, sorry.
Sorry, if I may add something, that's very, to me, a very important point as well, because one of the other misinformation stories which has been circulating, which they've tried to sort of muddle together with what Dr. Wood has put in her book, is this idea that nuclear devices of some type or another, there's various different flavours of this nonsense promulgated by people like Dmitry Karlazov, Ed Ward, Bill Deagle, and one or two other people, that a nuclear, one or more nuclear devices was used to destroy the World Trade Center towers. And what I say to people, to tie in with what Rob has just said, is that what you see looks nuclear. What John Hutchison does produces nuclear effects, or the either at the nuclear, atomic, or molecular level, or possibly at all three. And there are scientists that have looked into John Hutchison's research, and they, for example, have seemed to seems to show that it affects something called the van der Waals force, and this sort of thing. So people have looked into this research. It's not just some you know, some sort of messing about, not really doing anything important. It's huge, huge importance. And this connection to the nuclear phenomena is also discussed in Dr. Wood's book. People have tried to claim that it isn't. And so I just wanted to just jump in and make that point.
Yeah, on pages 366 to 372, I talk about this, the transmutation, and it actually show samples that Hutchison had tested, both the affected zones and the unaffected zones of the samples, and it's really striking, the difference in how things, the composition appears to have changed. And that, those tests were done by Dr. George Hathaway, you know, in a metallurgical lab.
Is this tied into low-energy nuclear reaction or some radiation stuff or whatever it's called, or is it like cold fusion type sets along the same line here we're talking?
It's a similar type of process and produces the same kind of symptoms.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I don't know that any of us can answer that exactly, but it certainly has many elements in common with that idea of a low energy, in the sense that the Hutchison didn't use a lot of energy to produce the results that he got, whereas a high-energy physics, you know, the kind of thing that we sort of associate it with nuclear devices, which are the bombs and the huge explosions and the shock waves traveling at supersonic speeds and the ultra-high temperatures. None of those things happened that day. There weren't supersonic shock waves. The dust cloud moved at a few tens of feet per second. There weren't temperatures that exceeded the surface temperature of the sun present in any of the images or physical samples left from the building. So the word nuclear is something that we have to be very careful about using, because it's a tiny bit confusing. And I want to be really careful with our choice of words and what we're implying, because one is a very much a high energy event, and one is as you've correctly identified, a low-energy nuclear event.
It would be right, sort of along the area where people want to talk about free energy type technology, along in that vein somehow.
I mean, if I must jump in with a couple of brief points, yes, I would think it's all interrelated. But as Rob said earlier on, there's a lot of muddle out there, and it's difficult to untangle it. And
okay, hold on a minute, Andrew, and we'll let you finish your thought. Let's go to break. Okay, we're back from break, and Andrew, you were talking. Go ahead, Andrew.
Right, and there's just another piece of circumstantial evidence I'd like to add to this sort of discussion at this point, and that is that one of the people who came onto the scene in 2005 was Professor Stephen E. Jones from Brigham Young University, who was the first proponent of one of the sort of explosive type theories for the destruction of the towers based around thermite, about which I've written quite a lot and documented quite a lot. But what I discovered in a couple of years later in 2007 was that Stephen E. Jones was involved in, guess what, cold fusion in the 1980s and 1990s. And he's mentioned on 100 pages of Dr. Eugene Maller's book about the cold fusion story called Fire from Ice. And so we have very clear indication that this person was given the task of drawing attention to this nonsense to take away people's minds from looking at the energy issues and the sorts of things that we've been covering in the first part of this program.
Okay, so he was basically what we want to call a false flag, a psyops guy or something?
Something like that, and he had knowledge of the sorts of things he needed to take people's attention away from. Now, of course, somebody like him is never going to admit that, but when you study this in more detail, you can pretty much be fairly clear that he must have been doing something like that. He did know better. He should have known better than what he was saying.
Well, there was two people that he destroyed there. Was it Fleischmann? And was there two people that came out right ahead or right in that same area? And he destroyed their reputation.
Fleischmann and Pons, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he was involved with that. I don't think it was just him that did it. There seems to be a whole group
effort,
of people.
Yeah,
exactly. So, you know, we would be being perhaps somewhat unfair to one individual. But, yeah, he was involved with that group, and he seemed to have an agenda.
Ten years later, it was Fleischmann and Pons was what they did was validated to be true.
MIT is publishing that they are still experimenting with cold fusion and achieving very high coefficient of performance results with their experiments. So one of the groups that came out initially and said that it was not reproducible or it was they couldn't reproduce what they did, therefore it wasn't valid, are now actually conducting tests themselves and getting good results. And they're actually bragging that they're getting better results than Fleischmann and Pons, which I find a little audacious. It's kind of like, hey.
Yeah, it turns out they had falsified the results to make it look like it was meaningless, you know, what Pons and Fleischmann had done. And it was learning about that that caused Eugene Maloff to resign in protest from being a full professor at MIT.
Which is not a job you quit unless you have very strong reasons to
right.
You know, the word free energy, I don't think we should use it. It's just, it's such a trigger word. And, you know, this is about 9/11, so, you know, we have a lot to talk about. But I feel that word triggers so much in people's minds, and they don't want to believe it or challenge it immediately or remember the Fleischmann and Pons thing. It's just confusing. So brings up a lot of stuff.
What I mean by free energy, which is in the title of my book, is energy, it's unconventional and is off the grid. It's not metered.
That's a good point. Yeah, sorry, Dr. Wood. Yeah, my apology.
You see what happened. Once you see what happened and understand, you see that, you know, the picture of this tower frothing up where all the molecules are just repelling each other or letting go or whatever they're doing. You say, wait a minute, if we could, you know, this is a free energy source. You know, we could, you know, tap that somehow, and it looks like it's limitless.
Okay, we're going to break. We'll be back for another hour. Stay tuned. We've got more factual stuff to bring forward. It's a great show. Back in a minute. Ralph Kermit Winter Road II with the Ralph Winter Road Show. By the way, that's a Cherokee morning song. People that haven't ever heard that before. I actually have some Cherokee in me.
It's a beautiful tune. Yeah, I liked it.
Yeah. I'm sorry, say again?
Oh, it was beautiful music. I liked it. It was nice to hear that. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, I like that. I like that type of music. Anyway, I have Dr. Judy Wood on out of the East Coast. I have Andrew Johnson out of the UK and Rob somewhere out in La La Land there. And we're talking about 911.
Hey, it's the Pacific Northwest. Go easy on
Pacific Northwest, okay.
La La Land. We take that personally up here.
Okay. All righty. And couple of other, there's so many factual issues. Some of the other astounding stuff that went on is that when this happened, we see all this, what you want to call steaming, this continual fuming going on days, and then they're bringing in dirt and stirring it up and hauling dirt out, and a building next door that looks like it's aged. They try to rebuild it, the bank, and they finally have to tear it down. But somebody want to address all this fuming stuff? What's going on? That's unusual.
Well, what I do is observe, and if you don't want to bias your observations, you need to pick neutral language. Develop new words if necessary, because if you don't know what a phenomenon is, using a word for a known phenomenon is incorrect, because then you're biasing your observation. If you call it smoke, then you think fire is the cause. So, yes, fumes is a good neutral term. So is this fuming coming up from the ground that we were told was, you know, fires burning, but there's no evidence of that. But it is strange. It's this haze that kept rising up from the debris field. Not a pile, a field. This is empty debris field.
And they were hauling in dirt and hauling dirt back out, right?
Right. And dumping the dirt down and then bring it back out. I saw images from the next morning, from the morning of the 12th, and these piles looks like a, you know, fresh wheelbarrow load of potting soil just dumped, nice clean pile. You know, how did that get there? Yeah, you know, you start noticing it all over the place.
Yeah, some of the pictures too, aerial pictures, are this quote fuming or whatever the word is here. Aerial. I mean, this continues going up. Now that's not part of a standard kinetic or a bomb or something. I mean,
or controlled demolition.
Yeah,
controlled demolitions. The fumes, you know, dust or whatnot, usually doesn't rise above the highest point of the original structure. This went way up, you know, and way up into the atmosphere.
The other thing about the fuming, which you pointed out, Dr. Wood, in your book, was that it started well before the justification event. You can see it on the backside of Tower 7. And it's also visible with John Hutchison's work when he shows, and it's a YouTube video, people can look at it, the metal specimen collapsing. It lathers up in the same way.
Well, we're going to break. We'll be back in just a minute. Continue on. Stay tuned. Okay, we're back from break. We're talking about 911, Dr. Wood, Andrew Johnson, and Ed Robert. And interesting thing about this fuming, and from a layperson's standpoint, I would tend to think when something happens, it's over. Like a nuclear bomb, it's over. Okay, there's radiation left over. But we see this continuing thing, and it looks like the dust doesn't stop maybe getting smaller or something. There's evidence of that. Anybody want to address that issue?
Well, that was another thing I had noticed, and that was also similar to the Hutchison effect, one of those characteristics, which is the larger the mass, the less it is self-quenching. I mean, it doesn't stop the reaction.
So in other words, it didn't just stop. It's continuing. And what evidence did you find that it's not self-quenching as concerning the dust?
Well, I'm sure it diminishes with time, but one real strange thing was that they repaired Bankers Trust. It had that gash in the front of it where it was facing Building 2. Mm-hmm. It had the gash in the front. They replaced the gash, and they repaired it all, and then they decided after they looked at some dust samples that they needed to dismantle the entire building.
Mm-hmm.
It seems pretty peculiar.
Seemed to me like I read in your book, too, about this dust that settles to the ground. All of a sudden, it looks like it's rising all after it's sitting there for a while.
That's one of the things I also noticed right after the demise of one of the towers. One block upwind, you can see blue sky off in the background. And then you notice this real fine, I call it fuzz balls, this fuzzy stuff around the feet of the firefighters. And you think about it, this is like 10 minutes after the tower's demise, maybe 15. This fine of dust could not have cleared out of the air in that amount of time. You know, I'm not saying it shouldn't be kicked up, but how did that fine of dust come out of the air so you can see a clear view, you know, in the distance, clear blue sky? That it has to have, you know, there's another picture right after just the first tower went, which is Tower 2, of a guy walking past a clock, so you can tell what time it is. It's 14 minutes after 10, which is before the demise of the North Tower. And you see the fuzzy stuff around his feet, but from his kneecaps upward, it's clear. The air is clear. And the only way that seems to occur is that coarse dust lands and then keeps breaking down and becomes finer dust.
Were there any experiments done on the size of the dust, and if I was wearing some sort of a mask, would it help me or not?
Oh, it was finer and finer and finer. It was down to the size of DNA, like a hundredth of the size of red blood cells. So those workers were inhaling that right directly into their bloodstream.
So those masks that they wore is worthless?
Right. Well, it keep out some big stuff, but it can't keep out the smaller and smaller stuff. And what you have is like every constituent of the building. If the whole building turned to dust, the dust has in it all the constituents of the building. And the most peculiar thing they found in it was an organic element, or organic material in it, the airborne part. So that right there is proof that it couldn't come from a hot source.
So basically we're talking about maybe parts of people or something, or plants or something.
Yeah, right. Something that would have burned up if it was high heat.
Wow. Yeah, that's a good characterization you've provided, this idea of an impulse event. This is language engineers would understand. And something very short duration, and then there was a steady decay after the event took place, versus something that is, as Dr. Wood has described it, something that isn't self-quenching. In fact, it appears to just continue, and the reactions are continuing. This idea that the dust falls to the ground, it's heavier than air, or the particles are dense enough, and there's enough of them that they fall to the ground, and then the reaction continues, and they begin to rise up off the ground as people walk by, and the air currents, the particles become so light that the air currents are able to lift them up. It's really quite extraordinary. I believe, and this, I'll let Dr. Wood answer this, but I think that I read somewhere where you once said that you went to the site many years later and you felt that there was still some reactions going on that you could sense or smell or taste or observe at ground zero there, that there were you considered that the site was quite reactive. And it appears to be supported that they took quite a few years. Now, I build buildings. I know how long it takes to develop a site. It doesn't take 10 years to get a construction project complete, you know? So why did it take so long? It's a good question.
Well, when I was there in 2007, they were hauling in dirt and hauling it out and watch it get dumped. And then we went like 2 days in a row. And the next day, the big pile was no longer a big pile. It was distributed out. That was in the fall, and we saw dirt trucks coming and going, and the diggers, I like to call them, the excavators, would hit something like they broke a puffball. Suddenly this big plume of fumes would kind of rise up out of it.
And are you serious? This you could actually observe this at ground zero, that these guys were bringing in mounds of dirt, dropping them on the ground. They weren't necessarily spreading them around or anything like that. And they'd come back the next day, and that would have dissolved or disintegrated or something.
It's hard to tell exactly, you know, what was going on where, but
yeah,
we were there 2 days in a row, and there was a big pile of, it looked like fresh potting soil. The day we came back, that pile wasn't there anymore. And you constantly see trucks coming and going with dirt in them. And excavator dug at something, this big puff came out, and there's a tourist woman standing there, and what on earth was that? And Russ Gerst was with us too, and he handed him a card to my website, and said, we call that fuming. You know, here, read more about it.
Take some pictures, try to take pictures around there when you were there?
Yes, on that visit, and there were pictures of the workers hosing each other's boots off. And it's also a picture, they open up the gates to let the dirt truck out, and they're still scrubbing it. Every single speck of dirt they're hosing off the trucks. And I went back there with Andrew in January in 2008, and it was still like when you walk completely around the perimeter of the site, you could tell different qualities in the air at different places. And it would make all this mucus like in your lungs, in your throat, that you have to kind of cough up and gag up. And when Andrew and I were driving back from New York towards D.C., like all the way down the New Jersey Turnpike, we were still coughing up this crud. And it took
both
about that
were.
Length. Yeah.
Both of you.
Well, I mean, it was, I had a bit of a sore throat, and there was definitely a reaction there, which, because I'm not normally prone to reacting to that sort of situation. You know, it was a bit of a cold day, and we have a lot of cold weather.
Yeah, you're
UK
from England,
it's not,
I mean.
Right, yeah. Exactly, you know. And
you go into London regularly, yeah.
Well, you know, the heart of the Industrial Revolution, of course. Still got a lot of that here. Well, not really, but I'm not normally sensitive to those sort of things. And I did notice it when we'd got in the car to drive away from Manhattan. And I was thinking, there's something there which I don't really think should have been here in this environment.
Did they try to control your taking any pictures internally or externally around 911 around that area?
What happened was there was a big fence around the site. You couldn't take pictures. And we tried to peek through some of the gaps and with limited success. And then what we actually did was we went into the Burger King there to get a bite to eat, and they had the first floor, and if you went up to the first floor to, you know, sit and eat there, you could see right into the site, and I got some good pictures from there.
The second floor,
that was really interesting. And we had this weird experience. There's a little synchronicity because I switched on my laptop computer, which I had with me, and I was looking for some wireless networks to attach to, and it shows you the names of the wireless networks. And I'm not kidding, but one of the names which came up on this wireless networks list was Fuzzballs, which is one of the names that Dr. Wood has used for one of the phenomena that she characterized, similar to the fuming. I think it's, you know, these little balls of fume, or maybe you'd better describe it.
Around the feet of the firefighters and so forth. It's just the fuzz.
So did you see any evidence of any steel there that's still aging somewhere while you were there?
Oh, there was lots of stuff that was rusting, but we need to know more of the history behind it. But it was incredibly bringing new steel, and it was almost like rusted to death. It was like rebars and so forth.
Mm-hmm. And everything. I took some pictures of that.
We went back. I went there with Russ Gerst a year ago, and again, you know, it wasn't quite as bad, but I felt like I was catching a cold, probably the stage that Andrew was at when he was there in 2008. You know, it wasn't as severe on me that, you know, last year, but it was still wanting to cough up the crud like you're getting sick. Yeah, like you have something happening, your immune system's working hard on something. And as soon as we crossed the river to the other side, you know, it's like standing in front of a nice air conditioning, you know, clean air. But you talked about
the Hudson River too. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not sure how clean that air is, but anyway.
But it felt it by comparison. But yeah. You talked about the air quality. When you go down to the PATH train station, right at the bottom, there's this gizmo, like a ion kind of thing. It's a, you know, a unit. And I wanted to take a picture of it, and they almost confiscated my camera. And I also was trying to take pictures of the beams at the top. You know, you look up, you know, underneath the ground level, And they're just, you know, this is a new structure. There's no rain down in there. Why is this stuff just super, super rusty?
Hold on a minute, Dr. Wood. We are going to break. We'll back a minute. Okay, back from break. Dr. Wood, you were talking about taking pictures down at down below. Let's go ahead.
Yeah, well, they have the picture police or the camera police. And you can't take pictures there or else they confiscate your camera. But you get on the subway and you go one stop and it's perfectly fine.
So why is that?
Well, I don't want to speculate.
Okay, well, let me ask you this. Did you see anything abnormal that you shouldn't have seen visually that you couldn't take a picture of concerning the environment, the iron, or anything like that?
Well, the super rusted beams, they're covered with a coating of some sort, but they're still super, super rusty. And they're, you know, it's a brand new structure, the PATH train station. But, you know, the next bit down, it's not at all rusty. And that's a lot older of a stop.
So we can presume there's something there if they don't let you take pictures. Why? You know, whenever the government says no, there's a reason. I got another thing that, you know, there was a storm front or something going on that you also researched out. You want to talk about that?
Well, yeah, when I was looking to see how far up these fumes went, I thought, okay, get some weather satellite images and let's see if we can see the fumes in those. And when I got them for that day, like, what is this? It's a huge hurricane. You can't miss it. You know, like at least 500 miles in diameter right off the end of Long Island. The outer bands were over Cape Cod. And it was raining there.
Was it a major hurricane or a little youngster?
Well, it was a Category 3, but not just the category. That just relates to the speed. But the whole weather system, you know, if you add up the cumulative, you know, energy of the system, it ended up being that it was stronger of a weather system than Katrina.
Okay, time frame, any correlation between the time frame and 911 in that hurricane?
Well, for 4 days straight, it was headed straight to New York. I haven't found any other hurricanes going perpendicular to land. Straight towards New York, and then kind of makes its hairpin turn, and it's about the closest to New York City at 8 a.m. that morning, approximately. And, you know, of course, it got a little bit bigger on that morning, so the cloud cover went even further. And it turned around, and that afternoon started heading out of town.
Now, this is the day of 911, right?
Yep, yep.
Was it widely reported or not?
I don't think there's too many people that are aware of it. Actually, it was Geraldo Rivera about a year ago said he's taking pride in all the hurricane chasing he's done for the past 40 years. He was sort of celebrating his 40-year anniversary of doing this and said, well, you know, it's too bad we didn't have a hurricane on 9/11. You know, so if only we'd had a hurricane on 9/11, that, as though that would have messed up, you know, airplane flight.
So it possibly may be tied into part of John Hutchinson's static energy or something along those lines for a directed energy weapon?
Well, the fact that it was, you know, coincidentally, like the closest there, and it went for 4 days like a beeline to Manhattan, then it made this U-turn and heads out of town that afternoon. It doesn't matter exactly when it turned because it's still, it's a huge hurricane. It produces a static field around it. You know, people say they can feel a storm coming. Uh-huh. That it produced a static field, and by golly, the three major airports around Manhattan all reported thunder that day. So it makes you start wondering about, what does a static field have to do with this?
If it had gone to shore, it could have really raised havoc with that area, right?
Oh, it didn't need to even go to shore. It just needed to hang out there a few more hours, and you would have horrific storm surges. Manhattan would have been flooded, and there's no way you'd be able to evacuate people that fast.
Uh-huh. Well, I'd like to talk about Vancouver at the bottom of the hour. Any other energy? I think, Peter, we got one caller that we've got. Did anybody else want to talk about any major pieces of evidence? And then maybe we'll touch on Vancouver and some other issues. Any other evidence you want to bring forward right now?
No, we've covered quite a bit.
I'd just like to say that there has been a huge cover-up of this, and Ralph, you've been very... good in the past about covering some of those angles with these various groups that have been set up. So, I think that's just worth pointing out that associated with this, there is indeed a cover-up, and it reaches further than most people would think initially before studying it.
Well, why don't we go into that if we want? I know, I think, Rob, you were in Vancouver, right?
I was lucky enough to attend the event in Vancouver, or part of it, yes.
Okay, well, my first question is, how many people showed up?
How many people were presenting, or how many people were in the audience?
Well, both, I guess. was the people on the stage presenting greater than the audience, or how did that work out?
I think that's a judgment call, but because I think they were very close in number, yeah, unfortunately. You know, it's a really good question. Why weren't there more people there? I mean, you have talked about this topic before, and we're all very interested in this topic. It's an extremely important topic. What was it about that event that it was so poorly attended?
Well, I know that I didn't go.
Yeah, you didn't go.
Right, and I know why I didn't go, because, you know, I understand what the evidence shows. There's no question about what the evidence shows. And it's not something that needs to be debated.
Yeah.
This group has kind of a history of muddling up things.
I had that impression when I was there. I'm an engineer. I go to technical conferences. I participate in technical conferences. I know what a good technical presentation looks like, and what sort of mediocre presentations look like. And I know how you present evidence. And I don't think that this conference met as much as they may have thought they did. I don't think they met a very high standard with.
Hold on just a minute, and we're going to get into that, and then a caller here. Back in a minute. Okay, we're back for a break here, and we're running out of time. We've got so many issues. Dr. Judy Wood, would you cover briefly, did NIST actually investigate the collapse, or whatever you want to call it? And also, very briefly, you filed a KTAM, a whistleblower suit, and cover those, and then we'll get into Vancouver. And
The NIST report does not address the quote, collapse of the buildings. And to even call it a collapse means you have to first determine it, whether or not it is a collapse. And I determined it was not a collapse. The buildings turned to dust. You can call it dustification, whatever, but it is not a collapse. And I called them on this, and they admitted that they did not investigate the collapse of the buildings. They just, everything leading up to when the building quit standing. So they said it didn't violate the laws of physics while it was still standing. And that's their, you know, the point at which they stopped investigating it. And because of that, that was fraud, because they were mandated by Congress to find out why and how the towers collapsed. They didn't do that, and which means that also their contractors are guilty of fraud. So I took it to court, because we can't sue a government agency, but you can sue the contractors of NIST for science fraud. And I filed a federal KTAM case. My request for corrections to NIST qualified me for that, because that was my act of whistleblowing. So that's as far as you can take it. And the defendants in this case were manufacturers and developers of, guess what, energy weapons.
Okay, and you went out. You listed Science Applications, International Corp, and Applied Research Associates Inc. That were two of them that you listed, correctly.
Right, right. And you know, if we could have put them under oath, you know, it seems more than likely that they know who did 9/11.
And the bottom line is, you went, you couldn't get anywhere in the United States District Court. You went up an appeal in the New York Appellate Court. And during the time, they modified the law for the whistleblower suit.
But they didn't exactly modify the law. What they did was Congress restated it, because that's when they were doing the bailouts. And they wanted mm-hmm. a way of having accountability for the bailouts. Because before, the courts were, you know, misinterpreting the law to think that, oh, we have to say, you know, it was premeditated, exactly where they were when they're, you know, thinking about committing fraud, and what the hour was on the clock at the minute hand and the second hand of the clock. Oh, you can't do that? Well, tough. But what Congress did was restate that you just have to show they knowingly allowed a fraudulent report to go forward, which uh-huh. is, you know, I clearly had. And and it applied to my case, this restatement. And the Court of Appeals judges were very respectful of me. They didn't have to say this, but they were respectful in saying that they were ignoring that law in order to dismiss the case.
Right, which is not unusual with these courts when it's too hot to handle. And, of course, going to the Supreme Court since 1988, the writ of certiorari is all discretionary, since Congress said they don't have to declare the law. But you didn't get sanctioned anyway, so you had the fact that nobody would touch them.
Right, right. And that is as close as we could have gotten, as any of us could have gotten. But, very few... When you're involved in a case, you can't advertise it. Other people can, but you yourself can't. And the Truth Movement didn't seem too interested in this case, except to silence it, which was interesting.
Okay, we've got Rob here, and we've got also Andrew that's done a tremendous amount of work on all of the, I'm going to use my word, psychops, obfuscation, every tactic in the world to keep from getting the empirical evidence out there. And in the Vancouver, I guess Rob attended that. Can you give us an oversight of or an overview of what happened? And Fetzer was one of the, instigator, what's the word? One of the people that was pushing that, right?
That's correct. Dr. Fetzer was a major element of the overall presentation in Vancouver. He participated in many of the presentations, introduced speakers, and was a big part of coordinating that event.
Okay. Go ahead.
And your interpretation or the words you're using there, I mean, everybody, as I say, everybody knows what a good presentation, what one isn't, and everybody sort of has a sense when they're, what the story is and those kinds of things. There's kind of a response to things. And I didn't feel that there was, as much as they sort of appeared, ostensibly anyway, to be presenting something that had some legal significance or some, credible scientific backing. None of that really washed over me particularly well. I felt that it was a psyops all the way through. Maybe not everyone thought that. There were people there that might have been there legitimately, but there were big elements of it that just didn't ring true with me, and I didn't feel very good about the content. Specifically, the person that stood in for Dr. Wood, and I thought it was inappropriate for someone to stand in for Dr. Wood. She has her book. The book wasn't even available until very late in the second day, in the resources that were people could get access to at the conference. Dr. Judy Wood's book, even though Dr. Judy Wood was discussed at length at this conference, her book wasn't even out on the table. So, anyway.
Okay, so my question then gets down to how does anybody qualify to present Dr. Judy Wood's book? I mean, she's highly qualified in her area of expertise, and I know a lot about her book, but I wouldn't even
I feel the same way. I feel exactly the same way. I'm a professional engineer, and I have a great deal of respect for her work, and I would take it on, but with extreme caution and with extreme respect, and admit my own limitations right up front. Obviously, with her several years of research into this topic, it's going to be very hard for anyone to do justice to all of the information she was able to uncover and all the pieces she was able to put together. The person that did the presentation on her behalf, whether it was an honest mistake or however it happened, I just don't feel they did justice to Dr. Wood's work. And there was just very significant elements of it that were missing. So, just as an example, I'll be quite specific. There was a slide, and you and I talked about this at the early part of this conversation, about showing the seismic data. That picture was out of focus. And you look at it and you go, why would that picture be out of focus? It's a very important piece of information. It's quite easy for someone putting a PowerPoint presentation together to do a reasonable job and to give the audience the respect that they deserve, which is to show the information and maybe to talk at length about the seismic data. Instead, we're sitting looking at a PowerPoint presentation supposedly done by a professional person that we can't even read image. We can't even make sense of it. It was just, to me, it wasn't the right thing to do. And the PowerPoint presentation itself, again, you know, whatever it was, I just feel, you know, the text choices, the font, the organization was all a little bit, it was a little bit below the level it should be at.
So you're saying basically it was a PSYOPs operation?
You know, that's what I'm saying. That was my opinion. I'm not going to back down from that. That's how it struck me.
Well, the
person concerned wrote to me. I'd been trying to get in touch with her because I knew that this person was going to represent Dr. Judy's research, and she claimed she was going to do a good job. And so I ended up writing to her and said, well, would it be possible for you to send me a copy of your PowerPoint presentation so that I can have a look at it? And eventually she did this, and you can find this on my website. It was posted on a blog, actually. Then after she sent me it, she said that it had been revised. So in other words, she revised this PowerPoint presentation after it had been given at the conference. So, you know, this is all very strange. And as we, you know, she was trying to say that she was trying to give a fair representation of Dr. Wood's research. And, you know, I mean, I've given talks where I've mentioned other people's research and so on, and I've done it to the best of my ability. But in this particular case, history has shown that most of the time that it's being represented, it's been misrepresented. And if they really wanted to give an accurate picture of what Dr. Judy Wood had said, they could have played portions of a video that we made in October last year, which has all the information there. It's a two-hour-long presentation. And if people are interested, they can find it on my website or Google Dr. Judy Wood St. Anne's, and I think it will come up, Dr. Judy Wood St. Anne's. And you can see all of this laid out for you in the right order and everything. And they could have just played it, you know, one or more segments from that, and that would have done the job without anybody having to put a PowerPoint presentation together. It would have come from the horse's mouth, so to speak, and that would have been done and dusted, sorted. They wouldn't have needed to pay any airfares, any hotel accommodation, nothing. They would have got all the information in the right place, in the right order, and nobody chose to do that.
Well, I will say one thing, and I don't want to spend time on it, but their judge-sworn nonsense and their indictment, I'm a legal researcher, and that is as much standing as smoke does out here in the wind when it's blowing the other direction. It's absolutely zero, zip, nada. It's a it's total illusionary nonsense. There is no sworn judge. You can't do indictments. They don't have any authority to do anything to anybody about anything. So
it was up in Canada. I mean, what does that tell you? Why?
Right.
Why was it in Vancouver? I don't know. Yeah.
No, that's a real good question. But judge sworn, it means nothing. Indictments mean nothing.
Yeah.
They have no authority to do anything. It's just an illusion for people that don't understand, to try to sucker people in and give them misinformation.
It looks that way, doesn't it?
Well,
I think.
Go ahead.
One of the difficulties is that when you go through those options, and we've covered this quite quickly, but when you sit and think about it, and you think about what we've just said, and you look at the evidence, you then think, well, what? So why has this been done then? Who's put up the money for this? Why would somebody want to go to this extent to create this event and create this impression and make all these statements about, you know, as you say, about indictments and so on? Why has somebody gone to that trouble? You have to think about that and try and look for an answer. And the
That's
answer
a very
that
good
you
question.
Tend to come
yeah.
up with. The answer that you tend to come up with is a very uncomfortable one, and also when we do broadcasts like this, you know, it can easily sound like a food fight, or you know, we're being very critical, and you know, somebody's trying to get this evidence out to the public, and they're just doing the best job they can, and then we come on and say it was no good. You know, I know we haven't quite said that, but you know, that will be the message that's taken, and so we end up looking bad purely for trying to actually describe how we think it should have been done. And there are many ways it could have been done a lot better. And at the end of the day, what's delivered into people's minds is, I think, deliberately not the right set of information, not at all. So that is the answer that really, for me, that this was a deliberate attempt to to make some people think that something is happening that's good when really nothing is happening. It's just generating more confusion and so on. And I wrote an article about this because of the follow-up correspondence that I had after the conference with two of the people that were involved, one of whom I know personally, actually, and I was actually quite I became somewhat downhearted because of that, because I knew this person, and so it's all rather sad, really.
I have a statement on her updated version of page 7. It ends with a statement. It says, I do not apologize for any errors. I do apologize for any errors I've made and missed in the notes about nukes or Dr. Wood's material. No presenter is perfect is my excuse.
Yeah, it feels like NLP to me. I mean, when you put in the word nukes in there, I want to add one other element to my description of the Vancouver event. They were constantly building this case, this idea of parallel structure, that nukes and Dr. Wood's research were somehow the same, or that there were somehow equivalents. And then one was a theory, and Dr. Fetzer commonly uses this term. There's one theory or there's the other theory, and we'll play the two off against each other. And Dr. Woods made some good points, of course, we have to admit that, but we've got to look at this nuclear stuff too, and that's got some important points as well. And of course, it's easy to dismiss the nuclear stuff, but it isn't easy because the people that support the nuke theory won't let it go away. We can dismiss it 100 different ways. We can provide all sorts of information that it simply isn't a complete or comprehensive explanation of what took place that day. And anyone who looks at it carefully can see that. Even if we do that, and we've tried, or I've tried, it still comes up, but what about the nukes? And you think, well, what does it take to get rid of this theory that nukes are somehow a valid explanation for a 10-second long, relatively low-speed dustification event? I don't know.
Well, I think one thing is that Andrew Johnson is, with his book, he's documented the continual players that keep reappearing, putting obfuscation, baloney nonsense out there to screw this up so that nobody can never get logically going in like Dr. Judy Wood's book and looking at the empirical evidence and say, darn, look at there. Oh, well, wow, look at that.
Yeah, I agree. Andrew's done a very good job of that. And if you want to understand how PSYOPs work, look at his material. It's a wonderful education. So it's very important for people to be aware of how this actually goes down, because it's a very edifying experience, believe me.
But once you see that, you start seeing it everywhere. Yeah. You know, when you hear something on the news, okay, what do they really mean?
Well, obviously, Dr. Wood, you were never going to attend that conference, I presume, right?
Right. I attend scientific conferences, and I have actually presented some of my material at an engineering conference that was invited by peer review. It was in 2006. Bet you few people realize that. And it was very well received.
Has anybody ever actually, I look at these lists on Amazon.com, ad nauseum, where Fetzer and some of these other folks just pound on the nonsense, this nukes and around, where has anybody ever actually taken your empirical evidence of the seismic recordings and all these things and actually said, no, it's not true?
No one has been able to refute a single thing in my book, nor can they, because it is all empirical evidence.
I think an important concept here, or an important point, is this book is a high-quality book. It's a textbook. It's hard-covered. And you are, now I see this, aren't you? You are extremely qualified, and this is the only in existence independent forensic investigation of 911 in existence today. Is that correct?
Correct.
The only one. Even the government didn't do one. Back in a minute. Back here, and we only got a little over 3 minutes. We got a caller, but I want to, in case we run out of time, I want to thank all three of my guests, Dr. Judy Wood, Andrew Johnson, and Rob, for being on the show. And Dr. Judy Wood, would you give out the information on how to get a hold of your book and that?
You can find it through my website, which is drjudywood.com. That's D-R-J-U-D-Y-W-O-D, four letters, .com. Or wheredidthetowersgo.com. All one word, wheredidthetowersgo.com.
Okay, and they can purchase your book there.
Yep.
Okay, Andrew Johnson, how do we get this information from you and your webpage?
Well, you can just Google Andrew Johnson and 9/11, or 9/11 Finding the Truth, my name, or you can go to checktheevidence.com or checktheevidence.co.uk. They'll take you to the same place, and you should find all the information there and how to email me if you want to contact me.
Great. Okay, let's take a caller. We've got one here, California. We don't have much time. You got a question for one of the guests, or all of them?
Well, very quickly, Ralph, I just wanted to mention that they were talking about transmutation of elements, and in a not in this current scientific concept. And George Osawa, in a book called Atomic Age and the Philosophy of the Far East, published in 1974, talked about that. And also, there was another book, Transmutation, that was published by him, talking
okay,
about
so,
the work.
So your question is about transmutation, then?
Well, I just wanted to point out that it happens biologically in our bodies that elements are transmuted from one to the other, particularly easily proved is potassium created from sodium, or starting with sodium.
Let me stop you there because we're running out of time, and I want to give each one of them just a short closing statement here, but thanks for calling. Dr. Wood, closing statement, anything you want to mention?
Look at the evidence. The evidence always tells the truth.
Andrew?
Oops, don't
Boston.
Hear Andrew.
Any closing statements you want to make before we, and then Rob?
Just to mention to against the caller, transmutation of elements in plants has been very well studied, and yes, check the evidence and you will find the truth.
Okay, Rob, you got any comment before we
thanks
go?
Thanks very much to the caller. I love getting those references. And, I'm just totally on side with Dr. Wood and Andrew's work there. They have led the way for all of us. So, and thank you again for your time with us today. I really appreciate it.
Well, I thank all of you for coming on because this evidence needs to get out there. I've read the book. And I don't have a PhD. I'm not a scientist, but it's easy to understand. And I checked it out, and it makes sense. It's logical. And, of course, Dr. Fetzer and some of those other ones, I lasted about 1 day or 2 days on their web pages, and I was barred. Because I don't put up with nonsense. I want to see some evidence here. And I think we had a great show. We got a lot of evidence out there. And if you want to go, where did the towers go? I really highly recommend purchasing the book. Read it. Check the evidence out yourself. Take nobody's word for anything. And if you want to see some of the nefarious deeds, get around and go to checktheevidence.com. And Andrew has documented all of the attacks, not all, but it's amazing, the psyops and all of the people that are out there to make sure that the evidence, that we never hear the truth. Or if we do, it's so screwed up, we couldn't find it in a haystack. So.
The truth is known, and it is knowable.
It is. And like I say, your book is going to go down one of the great books, I think, because you're the only one that's brought this out. Nobody's done it. I want to thank everybody again, and we got to go. And as I always close out my show, watch out for the federales. They're everywhere. Stay safe. We will see you next Sunday.